Let me begin by saying long-term committed relationships between two human beings, as in a marriage, are challenging to say the least. I hope you appreciate the diversity of literary and scriptural reflections on the experience of love and marriage in our service this morning. The opening hymn and the responsive reading are from the Apostle Paul's familiar letter to the Corinthians. Paul's letter, despite being over 2,000 years old, continues to be the most popular reading for wedding ceremonies. I find this a bit ironic because Paul's letter is addressed to a deeply divided church in Corinth. The letter was intended to address congregational conflict. I come now married for 36 years with some expertise in the topic of this morning's sermon. I have presided over hundreds of wedding ceremonies in my 30-some years of ministry. I have done a great deal of reflection with many young and as well as older couples on the challenges of love and marriage. In the wedding ceremony I have developed over the last 20 years, I have a brief introduction to the vows, which is adapted from an essay by the Kentucky poet Wendell Berry. Julie and I discovered this passage in an essay by Wendell Berry shortly before we were married and used it as the introduction to our vows. He writes, "The meaning of marriage begins in the giving of words. We cannot join ourselves to one another without giving our word, and this must be an unconditional giving. The promise must be absolute. For in joining ourselves to one another, we join the unknown. We can join one another only by joining the unknown. Because the condition of marriage is worldly and its meaning communal, no one party to it can be solely in charge. What you alone think it ought to be, it is not going to be. Where you alone think you want it to go, it is not going to go. It is going where the two of you and marriage, time, life, history, and the world will take it. You do not know the road you have committed your life to a way." It is a bit vague, but at the same time suggestive of the difficulties that lie ahead. It is my attempt to be real. You are not in charge. As I have grown older, I have come to appreciate a quotation by the great 19th century Unitarian preacher Theodore Parker, who wrote, "It takes years to marry completely two hearts. The golden marriage is a part of love the bridal day knows nothing of. Very few are married totally, and they only after some 40 or 50 years of gradual approach and experiment. Such a large and sweet fruit is a complete marriage that it needs a long summer to ripen in and then a long winter to mellow and season it." The truth is, love and marriage are difficult, and that is an understatement. Let's be real this morning. Over 50% of marriages in America end in divorce. After 36 years of marriage and almost 30 years of marrying people, I find myself wondering, how do marriage counselors and ministers sleep at night, knowing all they know about marriage and not screaming it to the world? Married couples in America now are like punched-out fighters, Lynn Darling writes in an essay titled For Better or Worse. Bathe in each other's sweat, too exhausted to break the clinch, hanging on to each other because it's the only alternative to falling down. Given the demands of an institution that essentially suggests that you jump into the abyss with a nearby stranger and emerge years later with a core of your being inextricably scrambled with his or hers, it's a wonder not that more marriages don't survive, but that more of them don't end in murder. Now, before anyone grows all nostalgic for some long-lost golden era, the way in which we like to imagine the 1950s, for example, when love and marriage was all joy and happiness as opposed to punched-out fighters, I want to refer you to a section of the Song of Songs, another traditional Old Testament biblical reading at weddings. "Bind me as a seal upon your heart, a sign upon your arm, for love is as fierce as death." And the text, then frequently edited out, goes on to say, "It's jealousy bitter as the grave, even its sparks are a raging fire, a devouring flame." So let us be honest. Love and intimacy is a difficult struggle, and that is an understatement. Joel Achenbach, a writer for the Washington Post, wrote this advice about love and marriage. I advise my friends, beware of love. You want a mate, not an object of adoration. If your decision to get married is contingent upon being in love, you run the risk of conjoining with someone whose deep inner monstrousness has been obscured by your blind infatuation. You should never get hitched simply because you are in some kind of emotionally aroused state that is surely going to peter out in a year or two. So perhaps I am not what you would call an incurable romantic, but you have to understand the central fact of love. It is a bait-and-switch operation. You are genetically compelled to fall in love with someone who is beautiful or handsome, sweet, charming, funny, who acts as though you are the center of the universe, who crawls into your bed and sets you to panting. You undergo a mind meld. Suddenly you anticipate each other's sentences. You get each other's jokes before anyone else in the room. The joy of this coming together is such that you seek a societal and familial sanction for it, and thus go through a ritual known as holy matrimony. Soon there is a new entity in the relationship, a fetus. The genes encoding your susceptibility to the love toxin have been perfectly replicated in the offspring, who will burst violently from the womb of the mother, radically changing the very environment in which the genetic replication became possible. The love partners must now devote all their psychic energies to raising a squealing, helpless, diapered individual who gradually turns into a brat and then a teenager, and then grows up to fall in love and repeats the cycle all over again. Not that marriage is bad, but by design, a marriage, a mating, must change. Big things you thought were so important, like a shared aesthetic, like all that intellectual compatibility, decline in insignificance. The relationship becomes a series of little things. On little things does a marriage rise and fall, like a mutual interest in drinking coffee and reading the newspaper at a leisurely pace. You find little things to cherish. You have a favorite chair. You develop a coffee ritual, a storybook ritual, some running jokes. From little things emerges something big, and you realize that being married with kids is the essential condition of your life, an immutable fact, something you don't ever want to change, just like true love. I did recently read that statistics reveal that marriage is bad for you, at least if you're female. Married women have the worst mental health in the country, whereas it appears that married men have the best. I'm sure my wife, Julie, will be happy to explain to me how that applies to the two of us on the way home. My interpretation is that whereas men have been reared to be independent, aggressive, rational, displaying no weakness, and in control of the situation, women are reared to be caretakers, sensitive and empathetic, the person who is trained to take care of husband and home. I will be the first to admit it is unfair. Love and intimacy has not come easily to me. If I was a woman and it was married to myself, the male version, that is, I would probably drive myself insane, and I doubt the marriage would last very long. Coming of age in the 1960s, I and many, many other baby boomers were shaped by what was euphemistically called the love generation, that is, free love, which is an oxymoron. Love is never free, and what is free is never, ever love. I grew up in a time of one-night affairs and throwaway relationships. We were the children of what the late philosophical curmudgeon Christopher Lash called a culture of narcissism. I came of age following World War II, when there was the rise of a managerial and professional elite, my father's generation, experimental in its values, disdainful of tradition, transient and unencumbered, shattering the sorts of standards that make institutions like marriage viable. Those of you who have watched the acclaimed TV series Mad Men on television know what I am talking about. This new elite, this meritocracy of America's emerging consumer culture, lacks such basic marital assets as loyalty and a sense of responsibility in its affirmation of individual freedom. The iconic image of male heroism for the professional elite was James Bond, while Hugh Hefner, the founder of Playboy magazine, was their philosopher of liberation. Ironically, the children of this professional elite created a romantic expression of the same cultural movement and then called themselves hippies and countercultural. 32 years ago, at the age of 34, very much a product of my generation, that is to say, having exhausted the fantasies of free love, I married Julie because, to be quite honest, I liked her version of myself better than my own. I married her because I loved her, because I felt more real with her than I had felt with anyone else. I'm not sure what, at the time, I meant by real. I suppose I was pleased by the person I saw reflected in her eyes. Through her, I found someone with whom I imagined writing the narrative of a life together. I loved Julie because she loved the same playwrights as me: Harold Pinter, Samuel Beckett, Ionesco, and Sam Shepard. She also loved jazz, Coltrane, Miles, Archie Shepp, and the blues, Muddy Waters, Howlin' Wolf, and B.B. King. Our first date was here in St. Louis. I had completed a graduate program in community organizing at Washington University, and she was studying dance and getting her teaching certificate in biology. It was Leap Day, February 29th, 37 years ago. We went to a performance of Pinter's No Man's Land being performed at Union Street Congregational Church, the church where I later learned her parents had been married six decades earlier. No, that would have been three decades. No. No. And then we went dancing to Electric Blues at a new, small, and all but empty club in St. Louis at that time, the Broadway Street Oyster House, while a blizzard blanketed the city in snow. And I loved her because when she danced, she abandoned herself to the pure joy of her body moving with mine. I loved her because she loved wine, baguettes, and stinky cheese, because she could carry a 40-pound backpack up a mountainside and never complain, unlike myself, because we could fight and the walls did not fall down, because she was more at home with being herself than any woman I knew, because she shouldered responsibility with ease, and because her eyes welled up with tears elicited by the everyday grace of ordinary people. According to the essayist Lynn Darling, that first few months of a romantic relationship is what she describes as the sonnet stage. All marriages begin in delusions, Darling writes, in the drug of love, in a lie. If not knowing who you are and who the other one is can be called a lie. All marriages begin in the myth of who we imagine we are in the eyes of the other. The myth is the shell under which the real marriage begins to take shape. The cracking of the shell, like the breakup of the ice on a spring-swollen river, can be a deafening thing. As the myth, the romance gives way reluctantly to the reality of daily life, the sonnet turns into a grocery list. All marriages, even the best of marriages, are mended garments. In marriage, you don't make it all better, but and oftentimes simply get over it. There are cycles to a marriage and domestic life, Lynn Darling writes, times you're in love, times when you coexist as amiable roommates, too busy to take much notice of each other as long as the domestic machinery is humming along. Times, too, when the air becomes too thin for you to breathe, the walls between you as translucent as membrane, when what you want is good, thick, concrete bunker style. I think that is when the bickering begins, Darling writes, the sharp tone to the casual comment, the stubborn refusal to give in, are the holes we puncture in the top of the lid to make sure enough air is getting in. This is what I mean when I say all marriages are mended garments. I warn all the couples that come to me to be married. I tell them, No one can predict the course of a marriage. Sometimes people grow apart, times and cycles change, ambitions collide, other interests intrude, personalities clash, weaknesses surface, pressures mount. Sometimes it was a mistake from the beginning, and there are some divorces that are truly made in heaven. Many of the best marriages are simply luck. People meet serendipitously. The chemistry is right. There is a fit, and the circumstances of their lives do not tear the fabric of their relationship. The wheel of fortune spins seemingly in their favor. Julie and I, like all married couples, have had our moments, bad days at the wheel of fortune. Both of us have punched holes in the marriage lid to let a little air in when we can't seem to breathe. Crises are inevitable. Shortly after our wedding, while we were out to eat at a small ethnic restaurant, I can recall making a comment that was obviously true and very disagreeable. I recall a dinner roll flying in my direction and bouncing off my forehead and landing miraculously on my dinner plate. That was amazing, I thought to myself, and better a dinner roll than her purse, as she got up and left with a car and the only charge card. What little humility I demonstrated in our conversation was more than made up in my humble apologies to the waiter, and not to speak of the many insights I gained during the long walk home that night. Well, we survived that night and all the other nights that have followed. However, building the bonds of marriage in an era of glorified individualism was not easy. In an era of self-actualization, we struggled to develop a mutual realization. In an era of immediate rewards, we struggled in recognizing the need of both our parts to make long-term sacrifices. In an era of self-interest, prenuptials, and contractual relationships, we struggled with the duties and obligations of a committed relationship. It is not easy standing against the current of messages instructing one and all to pursue easy gratification. In contrast to the possible rewards of freedom and independence, duties and obligations are dull and boring in the eyes of many. The major stumbling block to committed and fulfilling relationships is the false ideology of the self. It turns marriage into a game of monopoly. What people fail to understand is that love is a combination of apparent contradictions. If there is only independence without mutuality, there is the danger of the individual being used, lost, forgotten, or ultimately abandoned. And if there is only mutuality without independence, there is a danger of the couple being isolated, smothered, and singularly uncreative. A casual, do your own thing and I will do mine kind of independence can easily lead to casual infidelity. Movies like The Ice Storm and the 70s classic with Warren Beatty, Shampoo, depict the painful and destructive consequences of this kind of lifestyle. But the smothering mutuality of a clinging, overprotective marriage will lead to infidelity as well. Adultery becomes attractive under these circumstances. It is oftentimes an attempt to shatter the illusion of safety and predictability that generally comes when two people are in a committed relationship. Adultery is a misguided, and I emphasize, a misguided reaction to the dry rot that can set in a marriage. In marriage, the crisis of adultery forces couples to enter uncharted and often unpredictable emotional terrain. Husband and wife and life partners are forced to become someone other than the person they have become. Because adultery is the enemy of the predictable, settled life, but the ally of change, I believe there are valuable lessons in honoring its impulse while, and I'm emphasizing, while choosing not to act upon it. What, for example, is this impulse to be unfaithful telling us that we need to know? One writer reports that after interviewing a score of married people having affairs, he discovered a man who longed to travel alone and had a lover who lived 3 hours away. A woman who wanted to become a famous biographer became the lover of the world's foremost authority on the subject. Another woman yearned to be a painter, and her lover was a street musician. without realizing that these people had found themselves lovers who embodied their own unfulfilled dreams. They believed that their adulteries were giving them something their marriages couldn't. But in truth, their transgression replaced more significant change and growth. It was less transgressive to their idea of who they should be in their marriage to, say, travel long distance to see a lover than to journey someplace alone, to sleep with someone important than to try to become important, to spend stolen hours with a musician than to use the time to be creative. Their lovers uncannily revealed the secret yearnings of their own hearts, the unrealized longings of their own souls that required fulfillment, but that were still thwarted. Because adultery is such a common threat to marriage, it is good that we recognize in the impulse the self's yearning to realize its latent unfulfilled potential. Perhaps if we honor our frustrated desires, the impulse to stray will disappear. I also must state clearly that marriage is not for everyone. There is a joke in which a woman is asked why she never married, and she replies, "I have a dog that growls, a fireplace that smokes, a parrot that curses, and a cat that stays out all night. What do I need with a husband?" I have married many, many couples, young and old, gay and straight, and my advice to all of them is advice I learned as an interned minister right here from your minister emeritus, Earl Holt, those many, many years ago. The words that I believe he may still speak at weddings are these: "You will discover many things in the years before you. You will discover that marriage requires a lot of faith and hope as well as love. And you will discover that marriage requires many kinds of love. To marry is to commit oneself to a lifelong learning of all the intricacies of love and to never stop learning. Nothing matrimonial is absolutely certain. Different kinds of people make different sorts of marriages. When you love someone, you do not love them in exactly the same way from moment to moment. It is an impossibility. It is even a lie to pretend to. Yet that is what too many of us demand. We insist in the wrong kind of permanence, duration, and continuity, when the only continuity possible in love, as in all of life, is in growth. The commitment of marriage is the commitment to grow together. For a marriage is never a completed thing. It must be built like anything else. A happy wedlock is a long falling in love. It is a friendship of the highest order. It is not something created this day or in any one day, but only through a lifetime of learning and devotion. You should look forward from this day in confidence as well as joy to the life before you, to the marriage that you have the capacity to build together. Enjoy what you can together, endure what you must together, and through it all, through both the gifts and trials of life, may you always give thanks that you are together. Be of love a little more careful than of everything. Amen." And marriage, when it works, is a mystery made up of such a complicated ebb and flow of affection, admiration, fury, ritual, and gradually unfolding understanding that with the right person, it's not a bad way to live one's life. There are moments when Julie and I are back in the year one living the sonnet, and all the reasons we fell in love are so apparent. The barnacles of grievance and irritation removed so completely that I sometimes experience a furious frustration with marriage for the way it can bury love in the sludge of who takes out the trash, the way routine and grocery lists replace romance. The late American poet Denise Levertov wrote a beautiful little poem that captures both my pain and frustration. It is called "The Ache of Marriage." "The ache of marriage, thigh and tongue, beloved, are heavy with it. It throbs in the teeth. We look for communion and are turned away, beloved, each and each. It is Leviathan, and we in its belly looking for joy, some joy not to be known outside it. Two by two in the arc of the ache of it." In my marriage and in my intimate friendships as well, I have learned that love is a metamorphosis. When I learned to be gentle with another, I could then be gentle with myself. When I received affection from another, I could then give affection in return. When I related to the depth of another, I could then appreciate the depths of all. Through my marriage, a long repressed tenderness was set free. Because of love, the ache of love and marriage, I have changed and become something better. My prayer is that all of us find in all of our marriages and long, intimate friendships, places where we can discover and create such a deep and abiding love.